So this is a post from Ugo Bardi on Sunday, November 22nd, 2015. His blog is Cassandra's Legacy, and I just want to offer a little editorial note that over the last six, 7 months or so, Ugo Bardi has become a real favorite. We've already, my wife Connie Barlow and I have already loved John Michael Greer and Richard Heinberg and, of course, William Catton and Walter Youngquist, and I just like almost everything that Bardi writes. So this is called The Syrian Sickness. What crude oil gives, crude oil can take back. And then he has a quote at the beginning, or a little line at the beginning. Here he says, I argue that the origins of the Syrian collapse are to be found in the economic downturn generated by the general or the gradual depletion of Syrian oil reserves. Crude oil had created modern Syria. Crude oil has destroyed it. This phenomenon can be termed the Syrian sickness. And the question is, which country will be affected next? Crude oil is a great source of wealth for the countries that possess it, but it is also a wealth that comes as a cycle. Normally, the cycle spans several decades, sometimes even more than a century, so that those who live through it may completely miss the fact that they are headed to an end of their wealth. But the cycle is faster and especially visible in those areas where the amount of oil is modest. There, wealth and misery appear one after the other in a dramatic series of events. One of these rapid cycles of growth and decline is that of Syria. It is a country that never became a major world producer. Its maximum output was less than 1% of the world's total production when it peaked around 1995. And he has a graph below from Gail Trevberg's blog. For the small Syrian economy, however, this limited amount was very important. The Syrian oil production went through its cycle over a little more than three decades. Depletion generated progressively higher production costs, and that led to a scarcity of capital investments to keep production increasing, eventually forcing it to decline. The result was the bell-shaped production curve that is often called the Hubbard curve. Around 2011, the internal consumption curve crossed the production curve, and that transformed the country from an oil exporter to an oil importer. The crossover point corresponded to the start of the civil war. The IMF data show that the Syrian government's budget was still 25% dependent on oil in 2010. Data on what it was earlier is hard to find, but it is clear that it must have been much larger. It may well be that at the time of the peak, most of the government's revenues came from oil. Seen in this light, it is not surprising that the complete loss of these revenues generated a big turmoil. So, we can build up a narrative of what happened in Syria after the peak. With progressively lower oil revenues, the government was less and less able to afford the bureaucracy and the social services it used to provide. Gradually, it became also unable to afford an efficient police force and a functioning army. The middle class, that had been strongly dependent on the government's handouts, was badly hit. The most educated and wealthy ones left the country or at least moved their financial assets abroad. Those who were forced to remain saw their assets destroyed by hyperinflation and became an impoverished urban proletariat. At the same time, the countryside also went through an economic disaster, enhanced by the droughts created by climate change. At this point, a large number of young men, unemployed and without hope for the future, became cannon fodder for religious fanatics and for local warlords, often paid by foreign powers interested in carving out the country in pieces to be distributed among themselves. The destruction of whatever was left was also helped by economic sanction and aerial bombardments. The final result is what we see, the Syrian sickness. A near-terminal form of social sickness, it is hard to imagine when and how Syria will be able to recover even a shade of its former wealth and stability. The factors that led to the Syrian disaster are by no means limited to Syria alone. Yemen went through a nearly identical cycle, going through its peak of oil production in 2002 at levels smaller than those of Syria, but probably even more important for the local economy. The crossover point of production and consumption curves took place in 2013, and like Syria, the country is at present being destroyed by civil war and aerial bombardments. And then he has an image from Crude Oil Peak. It says Yemen crude oil production, exports, and consumption, so it's a visual chart that I can't describe, but worth seeing. There are several other examples of minor oil producers that went through similar cycles. Egypt, for instance, experienced the crossover of production and consumption in 2010, experiencing a phase of dramatic civil unrest. Egypt, however, did not collapse, most likely because the importance of oil in its economy was not as large as it was for Syria. Other examples of countries that experienced the crossover are Malaysia and Indonesia, also undergoing internal troubles, but no generalized collapse. No country is completely immune to the Syrian sickness, but some are less sensitive to it. At this point, the question is obvious. Given the known cases of Syrian sickness, given that depletion is unavoidable, which country is next in line? There are several candidates for a future crossover of production and consumption, but none seems to be very close to it. Venezuela, Iran, and Mexico may be the producers most at risk, but the critical moment may still be several years away in the future. No, he says only several years. But the most interesting and worrisome case is that of Saudi Arabia. The data shown below are from Mazamascience. He links to that. Most producers of the Arabian Peninsula, with the exception of Yemen, show a similar pattern. And then he has a chart. You see that despite the rapid increase in internal consumption, Saudi Arabia is still able to export about 2/3 of its production. But how about the future? Of course, extrapolations are always dangerous, but it doesn't seem that the production and consumption curves are destined to cross each other very soon. Hence, the country might still have at least a couple of decades of substantial oil export revenues. The problem is that the Saudi economy is heavily dependent on oil. 90% of the government revenues come from oil. So Saudi Arabia may not need to go through the crossover point to start experiencing troubles. Consider that it is nearly completely dependent on imports for the food its population consumes, and that the trend is worsening because of the depletion of local aquifers. You can imagine what the problem could become in case of a substitutional loss of financial resources coming from crude oil. If Saudi Arabia starts suffering of the Syrian sickness, the resulting disaster may make the Syrian collapse pale in comparison. Is there any hope for Saudi Arabia or any other producing country to avoid the Syrian sickness? There are several ways to postpone or reverse the decline of oil production if sufficient financial resources are available. However, these are just stopgap measures. Depletion is an irreversible process. I like that. Depletion is an irreversible process. A country can only prepare for it by building an alternative economic infrastructure while it is still possible. An opportunity that was missed in Syria. Today, Saudi Arabia doesn't lack the financial resource for massive investments in renewable energy that would provide an alternative to the collapse created by depletion. Unfortunately, it doesn't appear that these investments are being made, with the Saudi government preferring to engage in expensive military power games. That's a bad idea, not only for Saudi Arabia, but for the whole world. With more than 10% of the world's oil consumption provided by producers in the Arabian Peninsula, can you imagine what might happen if the region falls victim to the Syrian sickness? Crude oil has given a lot to Saudi Arabia. Crude oil can take a lot back from it. But there is still something that crude oil can never provide, and it is wisdom necessary to manage it well. Here's another post by Ugo Bardi from Monday, November 2nd, 2015. He typically posts on Mondays. 10 years that changed everything and prevented all change. We are 1 month away from the COP21 in Paris. That should change everything and will probably change nothing relevant. But change does occur, even though in ways that often surprise us and in ways we may not like to see. the past decade, has been a period of enormous changes and also a decade of gigantic efforts aimed at avoiding change at all costs. It is one of the many contradictions of our world. So let me try to tell the story of these difficult years. The acceleration of climate change. In 2005, climate change seemed to be still a relatively tame beast. The scenarios presented by the IPCC, at that time updated to 2001, showed gradual temperature increases, and the problems seemed to be decades away, if not centuries. But 2005 was also the year when it became clear that limiting warming to no more than 2 degrees Celsius was much more difficult than previously thought. At the same time, the concept that climate change is a nonlinear process started to penetrate the debate, and the danger of the runaway climate change was more and more understood. The events of the decade showed the rapid progression of climate change. Hurricanes, Katrina in 2005, Sandy in 2012, and many others, the melting of the ice caps, the melting of the permafrost, releasing its deadly charge of stored methane, giant forest fires, entire states going dry, the loss of biodiversity, the acidification of the oceans, and much more. It was found that high temperatures affect humans more than it was believed, and, as a last straw, that the negative effects on human behavior of increasing CO2 concentrations are much more important than previously believed. We are discovering with horror that we are transforming the planet into a gas chamber, and we don't know how to stop. The rise of denial. In 2005, the denial of climate science seemed to be in decline, to be buried in the dustbin of history by the accumulation of scientific knowledge on climate. It was not to be so. The campaign against science went into high gear, using the full range of propaganda techniques available. In 2008, we saw the so-called ClimateGate scandal, possibly the most successful negative PR campaign ever mounted. In 2011, the so-called pause meme was diffused by the Daily Mail, and it was another remarkably successful propaganda attack. Then, individual climate scientists were harassed, demonized, investigated, and even physically threatened, while the public was the objective of a barrage of contradictory information designed to create uncertainty and doubt. The campaign was successful, especially in the United States. During the 2012 presidential campaign, we saw both candidates avoiding the climate change issue as if it was laced with poison. And in 2015, we see something never seen before. None of the Republican presidential candidates agree that climate change is caused by human activities, and that's a problem. Denial remains a heavy burden to the attempt of doing something practical to stop climate change. The peak that wasn't. In 1998, Colin Campbell and Jean Laher re-examined, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, re-examined the ideas of Marion King Hubbert, who in the 1950s had introduced the concept of peaking for the production of crude oil. The calculations indicated that the world peak, what they dubbed peak oil, would occur in 2004-2005. It was a reasonably good prediction in terms of conventional oil, which seems to have peaked between 2005 and 2008. But Campbell and Laher had not considered the role of non-conventional oil, combustible liquids such as shale or tight, quote-unquote, oil. Using these new sources, the production of all liquids, quote-unquote, kept increasing, and that has made the concept of peak oil as popular, more or less, as Saddam Hussein was in the previous decade. The effort of the oil industry to produce from difficult resources led to various bad consequences for the ecosystem. Remember Monsanto in 2010? But the main one is that CO2 emissions did not decline as a consequence of depletion, as it might have been expected. The fading of green. In the 1990s, sustainability was still a fashionable idea, and green parties had considerable representation in many European parliaments. Over time, however, the political weight of the environmental movement has consistently eroded. The destiny of the green parties closely followed that of all the ideas about environmental sustainability, which are not anymore a part of the arsenal of slogans of winning politicians. Even the European Union, once the bulwark of reason and environmental consciousness, lost its focus, in particular with the mad hope of importing natural gas from the U.S. Most people all over the world seem to be busy with their day-to-day economic worries that they have no time or inclination to worry about an abstract entity called the environment, capital E, which seems to be an expensive luxury that we can't afford right now. It seems that the concept of growth has swept away the environment everywhere as the thing to cherish most. The financial collapse. The deep causes of great financial crisis of 2008 were never really understood and were reduced to contingent bad practices in finance. However, it was not just a financial crisis. It led the world's real economic machine to grind to a near complete stop. The crisis was overcome by printing more money, and the economy restarted to work. But it never recovered completely, and nobody knows whether another financial collapse is around the corner and what could possibly be done if it comes. The financial collapse showed the fragility of the whole system, and it fixated the attention of most people on financial monetary factors, often leading them to forget that there also exists a real world out there, and that the economy, quote-unquote, is not just financial transactions, but it means providing material resources for society to survive. Editor's note, John Michael Greer, in his book The Wealth of Nature, does a lot with the primary economy, the secondary economy, and the tertiary economy. It's only the tertiary economy that's the financial economy. The rise of conflicts. Military confrontation and violent strife are on the rise. We have seen tanks rolling in the very heart of Europe and an immense strip of land and a nearly contiguous military confrontation from North Africa to the Middle East and all the way further to Afghanistan. Entire nations are crumbling down under massive arterial bombing and civil strife, producing hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing. It's like a fire that flared once and is now growing, engulfing one country after another. And nobody can say where the fire will stop, if it will. The only thing we can say is that destructive conflict tends to erupt in those states where the economy was in large part supported by the revenues from fossil fuel exports and where depletion led to the total or partial loss of this revenue. This was the case, for instance, of Egypt, Yemen, and Syria. The struggle may also be related to climate change and the consequent drought, as it is in the case of Syria. We can't say for sure. All of this is a harbinger of things to come in other places, but it might well be. And more. The above is not an exhaustive list of all the things that have been going on during the past decade. One could add the erosion of democracy and of personal freedom in the West, the decline or even the collapse of several national economies, the ongoing deglobalization, the increasing competition for rare and limited mineral resources, and much more. But all these events have a common origin. In all cases, people and institutions reacted to change by trying to stop it. For instance, facing the oil and gas depletion, the industry reacted by doubling the effort to find more at all costs, both financial and environmental. And they also stepped up its effort to deny the existence and the danger of climate change. Then, most people tried to solve their immediate economic difficulties by working hard and ignoring the deep reasons of their troubles. And here we are. After a decade of effort to ignore and contain changes, we are facing unavoidable and drastic changes, and we don't know how exactly to adapt to these changes. It is a difficult time that we are facing. On the other hand, there has been at least one positive trend during the past 10 years. The renewable revolution. Solar and wind technologies have dramatically improved in terms of both costs and efficiency. There have been no technological miracles, just steady incremental improvements. The result is that in 10 years, renewables such as silicon-based photovoltaics and wind plants have grown from toys for environmentalists to serious technologies that can produce energy at costs competitive with those of fossil fuels. Renewable energy is the greatest hope we have for a non-destructive adaptation to the unavoidable changes ahead. It will not be easy, but it seems to be possible. We need to work hard on it.